From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear this show at KCRW.com. It's been a while since my guest, writer-director Guy Ritchie's been here. In the movies he's made, of course, Snatch, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, Rock and Roller, he brought a high-voltage filmmaking style to the streets of London. He's gone back a bit farther in time to that same thing with Sherlock Holmes. First of all, Guy, welcome back. Good to have you back.
Nice to see you, Elvis.
Tell me about what made you want to do Sherlock Holmes in the first place.
I was deeply invested in the narratives as a boy. I knew them all very well, almost fluently. I listened to them all on tape before I could read.
Who was doing the voice? Do you remember it all?
I have no idea. you know, it's always, I'm never sure who does what to whom, and I can never attribute any credit or any name to any kind of creative experience I ever have. For some reason, I'm not invested or interested particularly in who that person is. I don't know why. Maybe that's lazy. I'm not quite sure. But there's the other part of me that likes being purely audience, that doesn't want to know too much about the process. I just want to sort of roll over and let the experience just wash over me. And I don't want to lose that, you know what I mean? I don't want to overthink it.
What you do is you make experiences that sweep people into it almost right away. I mean, there's a real adrenaline burst that almost seems to come, based on what we were saying before we got started, on your work in Brazilian martial arts. You want people to get their hearts racing that way that you do when you're working out.
Yes. It's funny. A lot of the filmmakers I've been influenced by, I say I've been influenced by, or a lot of the filmmakers that I think are brilliant, like Terrence Malick, moves at a pace which, you know, snails struggle to keep up with. But, I really enjoy that. And, you know, I can watch his movies. I never think his movies are long enough. But, you know, some people struggle with the pace of those movies. But my disposition lends itself to going at a much higher rate of knots. So there's a disparity between my disposition and what it is that I appreciate in others. Brazilian jiu-jitsu has been very informative. You know, I train for an hour a day, so it grounds me, I think, more than anything else. I just love fighters. I've always loved fighters. I've always found them to be tremendously friendly, tremendously welcoming. Find them to be honest.
Okay.
It's all that hard work, you know what I mean? It's hard work.
Well, it's just that kind of discipline, basically.
Yes, it is.
Just, and that real commitment where you just... It's all about you trusting your body, isn't it?
I think it's a bit of both. I think it's, you know, it's commitment, right? Both physically and intellectually. There's something about fighters that are just, it's that tenacity. I'm really drawn to tenacious people.
There is often an odd kind of contemplative quality. I mean, there's at least one person in each one of your films, often the protagonist, who has to be the person who's trying to, like, make sense out of things. And which kind of makes you the perfect guy to do Sherlock Holmes, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, life is a journey, isn't it? And that journey is ultimately about trying to make sense out of it all, or so at least put it into some kind of a form that the literal mind can understand. And I suppose that's partly why people are attracted to detectives. I think there's kind of an unconscious agenda there that is there is an unconscious desire to know what's the meaning of life. And I suppose to a degree, philosophy and detection are in some kind of empathy there, because the two are not mutually exclusive. And I can't help but feel that the agenda is ultimately the same.
Just to watch the movies to get ready for this, there's always one person who is basically trying to sort of make a sense out of a puzzle in each one of the movies. And that's an interesting character to have. And I wonder if, to some extent, that's you. If that you're making yourself kind of the audience surrogate who's trying to be at least a step ahead. And this is the first time you've got somebody who sort of is a step ahead of everything, but generally your protagonist is not. You know what I mean? He's trying to figure things out as they're happening.
Yeah. You have the benefit, of course, of being slightly more objective than I. I'm so caught up in the mix, I'm not quite sure what it is that I'm trying to do.
But do you not see that?
No, I don't. But I instinctively know that you're right.
Okay.
Right? But I'm sort of caught up in it. I'm caught up in the equation, and thereby I can't be that objective about it. But I can tell you, because I can feel it viscerally, I am in my films. You can't help but somehow exercise some degree of your interest and your personality upon the narrative.
I should say it's The Treatment. I'm talking to Guy Ritchie, whose new film as director is Sherlock Holmes. I guess I'm just asking this because reflexively, there's always a lot of action going on and somebody asking questions about it. And it comes almost down to this schism between the mental self, the psychological self, and the physical self, which is a real part of the way your films work.
Right. This I can talk something about.
Okay.
I think that's all life is trying to reconcile physics with metaphysics, the intellectual mind with the visceral self. That's really all life is, and that's, I suppose, all my life is trying to have those two walk in some, to reconcile the disparity between the two. It's yin and yang, it's positive and it's negative, it's day and it's night, it's black and it's white. Almost sounded like I said that before.
Maybe a little bit practice that day.
By the way, never said that before.
Is that true?
Yeah, it started to sound like a song.
It's a little bit, yeah.
I know.
It's, Sherlock Holmes is the first character you worked in the creation of who actually has both these things happening in him rather than, you know, two sides, you know, basically two tribes warring, one being the mental side, one being the physical side. Holmes is the guy who has both these things fighting in him at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, this is reflective of Revolver, which was just about this. And to a degree, this is, you know, Sherlock Holmes is, a reflection of the human condition, right? Without trying to sound too intellectually pretentious about this particular situation. But Sherlock Holmes is a deeply flawed but deeply brilliant individual. And Conan Doyle has created an icon which has lasted for 120-odd years and still has as much resonance today as had 120 years ago. I suppose, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why I'm attracted to this character. But this kind of dancing on the fine line of genius and madness is where Sherlock Holmes resides. He has more than three dimensions, Sherlock Holmes.
But there's also that obsessive quality. What's that word? Ratiocination, where he's constantly having to assess everything that's going on around him. I mean, it's almost a kind of OCD for him, especially in the way that it's written here for Downey to play.
Yeah, which is both a blessing and a curse. And we try to illustrate that relatively quickly within the film, that, you know, this genius can backfire. And, of course, that makes it infinitely more interesting and gives it dimension.
You've also made him feel more down to earth. I mean, more of an earthy figure than we've ever seen in film before. And I wonder if that was just your collaboration with Downey or if that was something you knew going into it.
Well, funny enough, I've never seen any of the other productions of Sherlock Holmes. I only know Sherlock Holmes through tape and a little bit of reading. So I have a complete mental image which isn't contaminated by anything other than the obvious symbols of a pipe and a deerstalker hat. Putting those two aside, which obviously we did, because they didn't even come from the source material itself, so it seemed no point to be shackled to that particular symbol. So I had an image of who Holmes should be, and Downey had an image of who that should be. Now, when you say earthy, that was a very long way going around. What do you mean by earthy?
I just mean just not patrician in that way, you know. I mean, which is, but you're saying you don't really know the film, so you wouldn't know that was the way he was treated before. It was literally a very tweedy character, and you moved away from right down to giving him a belt, which is a real working class thing rather than not having a belt.
Yeah, Downey and I were very much in agreement about exactly how Sherlock would be portrayed, and We try to leave the sort of the toffee tweed thing behind, and although Robert and I have espoused it off camera, we try to not espouse it on camera or to promulgate it any further. What we wanted was a more accessible Sherlock Holmes. I suppose that speaks. Also, it's tremendously hard to understand the complexity of English society. One could argue it's fortuitously broken down enough now to make it rather endearing. There was a point where it had so much currency that it was very difficult for anyone to function or transcend the English class system previously. But, you know, it's been emasculated now. And now, as I say, it's sort of rather endearing. It's rather like the royal family. I love the royal family and I love the idea of the royal family, but partly because they don't have great big biceps. And if they still did, then it'd be a tricky position. But now it's taken on a sort of nostalgic quality. And I suppose that's to a degree that does inform our decision as to why Sherlock Holmes is probably more earthy. And although he sounds like a toff, he doesn't necessarily look like a toff. I think he's more accessible than how he would have previously been portrayed. Simply that I don't think our culture would really accept that in a way that they could accept this portrayal of Sherlock Holmes.
You're listening to The Treatment. My guest is director Guy Ritchie. His new film is Sherlock Holmes. As you're saying this, I think about the thing that, to me, really feels like a Guy Ritchie sequence, and it's very Sherlock Holmes in this way, and making it very physical. That first fight sequence where he's using what you could say are powers of ratiocination, at the same time he's beating an opponent. I mean, he's doing all those things, just reading the situation and acting in the middle of it. And it seems to me that that becomes the intersection where you and Conan Doyle connect.
Yes. And by the way, I have a sympathy for the way Conan Doyle thinks, right? Everything that he was interested in, I am interested in. So I think he was kind of a holistic thinker, Conan Doyle, and he was tremendously into kind of the reconciliation of everything. And there was a movement that took place at that period where there were all sorts of significant characters that were involved in thinking big. The character that he's created is a character that I'm innately interested in.
What made you think that Downey was the guy for it?
Well, because I think Downey's also part of that parcel. So Downey, I cannot think of, with the benefit of hindsight, I can't think of anyone that's more suitable for playing Sherlock Holmes. But at the same time, I'd like the fact he's American. So
because why?
Well, because that makes him an actor. The trouble is he's almost too close to play Sherlock Holmes, and that almost stops him from acting. At least when he's American, it gives him some space. You know, if Robert Downey was English, I couldn't help but feel as though he would be Sherlock Holmes. You know, Robert Downey's intellect works at an alarming rate of knots. So I can never keep up with him. I never understand what he's... Actually, he's got much better at explaining what he means now. Rather like me, I'm sort of... I find it hard to follow what I'm thinking about. Downey's 10 times worse than I am. You know, he starts a point and by the time he's got to the end of it, I have no idea, what the starting point was. So Downey has a tremendously fast intellect and it is all over the place. I mean, he truly is a very significant individual. His mind works. And he also is very funny. Downey's very, very funny. So he's very funny. He's very broad. He's very smart. And he's tremendously flawed. And less and less so as time's gone on. But, there's so much as admirable about Robert Downey. You know, he is the prodigal son. He is the guy that's been there and has come back again. But not only has he come back, I mean, he's really come back. I mean, Robert Downey is a tremendously broad individual. He's lived a life, and now he has a full life and he's, 44 years old or whatever he is. And really his life's just beginning. But at least he now knows, what life is all about. I think there's a correlation between that and Sherlock Holmes,
How so?
Well, because Sherlock Holmes is a deeply flawed but deeply brilliant individual, mm-hmm. And he experiments with all sorts of narcotics, which, nowadays we know that it's dangerous to tinker with these things. Well, back in 1890, Conan Doyle was talking about injecting cocaine,
yes.
Right? He was the first Western martial artist. He had his fingers in as many pies that could be cooked in as many pie shops as there were in London. So it was a very experimental period. And I think Robert Downey there's a correlation between that and Robert Downey. Robert Downey is a live individual. Sherlock Holmes was a very live individual.
We'll take a break and see if Guy Ritchie has anything left to say in the second half of the show. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. It's good to have my guest, Guy Ritchie, back here sitting across from me. He's talking about his new film, Sherlock Holmes.
Well, he's trying to talk about Sherlock Holmes. He keeps getting distracted and talking about all sorts of other things.
Which lead back to Sherlock Holmes.
Yes,
Yes. Now, I guess because I don't want to ask you too much about giving away too much of the plot because it's fairly labyrinthine anyway, but I just wonder how long it took to decide on a way to go with it, and also about the casting of Jude Law, who a lot of people might have thought you would have wanted to have play Sherlock Holmes, playing Watson instead.
The creative process really happened very organically and very speedily. They came to me with a script of sorts, and Lionel Wigram, who was the sort of producer that was pioneering the whole idea of Sherlock Holmes, and he and I had agreement. But he came to me and he said, listen, what I want, what he pitched at the studio was, I want the Guy Ritchie version of Sherlock Holmes. So when he came to me, he said, look, how do you fancy this? I've got to tell you, I fancied it. I fancied it for all sorts of reasons, partly because I just fancied getting away from what it is that I do, but at the same time holding on to some kind of an English identity, spending more money because I like toys, and I wanted a bigger tapestry. So anyway, the script came to me, and we sat down and we worked very hard. Then as this process was going along, I ended up speaking to Robert. And Robert and I had a long conversation, of which I didn't understand much of, because these were in the days where he was almost impossible to understand. So all that I could tell, that he was very smart. I just didn't know quite what he was smart about. And of course, then it dawns on me. I think I felt sort of racist, if that would be the term used here, that I thought, well, I couldn't ever use an American. You'd have to use a Brit, which is just silly, because the whole idea of having an actor is they act. So then I entertained it for 10 minutes longer. I had a conversation with Lionel and a couple of others, and they went, duh, tell me what's wrong with Robert Downey Jr. After 15 minutes, I slapped myself very hard on the back of the head and went, what could be a better fit than Robert Downey Jr.? So, of course, got back on the phone and remembered he was a movie star, and then tried as hard as I could to get him on side. And he came on, and then he had all sorts of opinions. One of the fantastic things about Robert is he's an enthusiast. So once he's on board, he's on board. Sure. He turns up early to work. He's not a pain in the ass to work with. Well, that's not strictly true, but I can deal with that. You know what I mean? I can deal with that. What I care for is enthusiasm. I just don't want to work with people that don't want to work. Robert wants to work. Anyway, so Robert and I were in discussion, and then Robert and I went through all sorts of characters that we thought could play Watson. And then I think they were in America. I went and met Jude in his home in London. I've met him several times before. Had a few beers with him. I think I had more beers than him. and then Rob came over, and then I put those two together. It was rather like an arranged marriage while I stood over the pair of them and, kept filling up cups of tea and hoping that it would work. And sure enough, within 10 seconds, it became obvious that they were going to be mates off camera. So I think it was just a sort of natural fit that they'd be mates on camera. So they were tremendously enthusiastic, the pair of them. And I think Jude's kind of enthusiasm has built, actually, as time's gone on. But I think people have received Jude in this very warmly. I love Jude in this. I mean, it's very hard not to have an affection for Jude in this film. We all became in conspiracy with one another. We're in conspiracy in a positive sense about how we thought this should go. And it picked up such a momentum as each day went by. I mean, I'm kind of a feral director anyway, in the respect that I have no idea what I'm going to shoot the next day at all. I have no idea what the scene is. And it's as soon as the scene is presented to me, I obviously know the scripts very well because I work on them a great deal. So and I think that's the advantage of being as a writer-director, is that you know the script so well that then you just forget about the script. And incidentally, now I have no idea what scene when I go and watch a movie. Rather like it's related to my sort of disinterest in credits. I'm disinterested in what the next scene is until the next scene appears.
Wow.
So I have, I can be relatively objective in this sense. So it's probably a good thing and a bad thing. I never know what scene's coming next. I never know how the plot's going to unravel itself. So I can watch my own films 10, 20, 30, 40 times and completely forget that I've watched it previously. So that's one of the benefits of having this syndrome.
It's the treat of my guest who gets immersed in every film he's watching, even if they're his. This Guy Ritchie, the film we're talking about, is Sherlock Holmes. Before we go any further with that, though, one of the things I want to ask you about was, you mentioned Revolver, which I feel like is one of your most personal films. So many of your films, for the most part, most of them are set at a period I would call twilight, where it seems to be between sort of dusk and dawn at the point where we're not quite sure the sun's just gone down or the sun's just come up. And Revolver takes place almost entirely in that time. And I just wondered, the immersion in that project and the feeling so personal made it feel like maybe it was time to turn to a bigger studio film for you.
Yeah, it's certainly true. There's certainly a relationship with that. I mean, Revolver's deeply esoteric and also deeply personal. But
do you know what I mean about that sort of Twilight?
I do. I mean, well, partly because I like the stylish aesthetic anyway, and Twilight is a stylish aesthetic, right? Is it morning or is it evening? You can get lost in the ambiguity of that, and I quite like that.
Yeah.
Because it's a sort of stylish mechanism. I spent so much time working on Revolver, and every line, every metaphor, everything that's in there relates and correlates to, you know, a whole. So, having made it, I realised how hard it is for other people to access that. Now, you know, Sherlock Holmes isn't hard for people to access, and it's, you know, it's entertainment. But at the same time, I hope it has more than one dimension. And I suppose as I've evolved and as I've changed as a film director, really what you want is different dimensions to a film. So it can be accessed at a level by some, and it can be accessed at a different dimension by others. Now, the trouble is with something, the tricky thing is with something like Revolver, is it's all at a level that's kind of not literal. I mean, Sherlock Holmes has a literal narrative, and then there's different degrees of esotericism within that, right? You can glean what it is that you wish to if you care to sort of go any deeper. It looks conspicuously like it's a broadly accessible movie, but I just think it inherent within the character, it just can't be.
See, because the thing that makes me connect Holmes to Revolver is it takes place in a kind of spiritual limbo. You know, I mean, he's sort of like between stations in the movie as a character, in the same way that Jason Statham was between stations in so many ways in Revolver. And I see that connection, at least I do. And I wonder where that comes from.
It is ultimately the most important thing to me, because I suppose I'm trying to make sense of the universe.
Huh. But the idea of setting that in something that's, for the most part, not esoteric, is basically like action, and like I said, really very highly adrenalized and very stylized in the storytelling. But still, that kind of question is, what next? The big cosmic what next? And also, what just happened? These are bookends for you.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is about physicality just represents one aspect, right? And there's the other, that represents the physical aspect, the most manifest aspect. Now, life is about these two polarities, right? It's about what's physically manifest, which is very physical and very animated. And at the other side, it's about that which is concealed and not animated at all by its very definition. So there is that which is revealed, which is animated, and that which is concealed, which is dormant. And the intellectual world is just that. It's unseen and metaphysical. And there's the real world, the world of action. Now, films operate about reconciling the disparity between these two worlds. I tell you, there's a story that I'm relatively interested in at the moment, is Excalibur, right? And the story of Excalibur is about this very thing, right? Sure. The story of Beowulf. I love the film Beowulf, actually, just because I'm deeply invested in the complexity of that narrative, which is a very simple narrative, but all its metaphors I find deeply interesting and very eloquent, incidentally, because it's only about one thing. It's about reconciling this disparity, which comes up. I mean, that's all. Every narrative is about, to some degree, reconciling this disparity.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Guy Ritchie about his new film as director, Sherlock Holmes. You were saying about Excalibur, and I was wondering if you were a fan of John Borman's Excalibur, just because a lot of these things you're talking about, that test between the physical and the metaphysical, I mean, asking those questions and wondering where the next question is going to come, and also testing oneself physically is a big part of that film too.
Okay, so let's take everyone knows this story in Excalibur. It's the extraction of the sword from the stone. Right? Now, you ask your average man, what's the extraction of the sword from the stone? You ask your average filmmaker, and they'll say, oh, it's about, there's some ambiguity exactly what it's about. And in my mind, it's not ambiguous. It's what it's about is about physics controlling metaphysics. Who controls what? Does the intellectual or spiritual world control the physical world? The sword is, if you can control it from a place of spiritual orientation, a positive place of spiritual orientation, the antithesis of selfishness, then you can control physicality. And that's really what the whole story of Excalibur is about, is the man that can control mind over matter and hence he can control Excalibur. Once you're onto that, then you can see that the rest of the story is simply commentary about that. And vanity and pride creep into the equation, and every time that happens, the sword snaps, or, you know, there's great ramifications. But now the interesting thing is that when there's a reconciliation and everything's perfect, then chaos starts again, because life is not about perfection. It's all about chaos. It's all about action. Life is action. And I suppose all film, and why we need film and why we need story, is commentary upon this chaos. And is chaos really a bad thing?
It's funny, because as you say this, it makes me wonder now, because you've seen Holmes a number of times, as you just said here. Do you feel like you managed to reconcile all these elements in the way that you're happy with? Because it felt to me, even though it's a pretty far field, so connected in a number of ways to what you were doing and getting at in Revolver. Are you happy the way you sort of melded all these worlds together, narrative and also that subtext you're talking about? Are you happy with it?
Are we talking about in my life, or are we talking about in a story?
In Sherlock Holmes, are you happy with the way it's played out there?
I mean, to a degree, that's what Sherlock Holmes is about, right? That's what it's about, and his journey
but
in a more literal.
But I don't think anybody, you don't know the films, but they've basically always worked as kind of superficial mysteries. The mystery is solved, and you move on to the next thing. There's almost like this omnivorous aspect to those films. There's a constant motion of consuming. And there's, you know, a lot of texture, and as we're saying here, subtext. I just wonder if you feel like you got it. I mean, because there's clearly a lot you were wrestling with, and you wanted to make a studio film, but also make a personal stamp with it too.
Well, okay, I think there's a few questions and a few answers involved in there. I mean, by definition, Sherlock Holmes doesn't have a beginning and an end.
Okay.
Right? Because it's an ongoing process.
Sure.
Right, by definition. Then the next layer is that there is different layers of removing ambiguity, detection. And in this particular narrative, it's about smoke and mirrors in the physical domain and how Sherlock Holmes reveals that it's just smoke and mirrors. Show us a puzzle and then solve it. So there's that aspect of it. I'm tremendously happy that within the field that I was given to make a film that I found broadly accessible and entertaining and at the same time worthwhile. I find it aesthetically rewarding. I find it stylish. It's all, everything about this film I enjoy. Is that what I set out to do? And is that what the studio set out to do? Yes. And we are all in cahoots. We're all conspiring in concert to make manifest a sort of broadly entertaining movie. And I think that's what we've done.
Well, great. We're out of time. Guy, thanks so much for being here. And I'm sorry you weren't here for Rock and Roll, but come back for the next one, will you?
Elvis, thank you very much. Now you've got me talking, don't want to shut up.
Well, we got to go. We're out of time. My guest is Guy Ritchie. His new film is director is Sherlock Holmes. Our recording engineer at Carnegie Recording in New York is Leszek Wojciech. Bob Carlson is the editor. Timmy Dempsey is the producer. I'm going to go solve a puzzle. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.